Chapter 18. Amiable personality, I observed seeing fine on the point of falling into a brown study. But I could not help adding with meaning, he hadn't the gift of prophecy though. Fine got up suddenly with a muttered, oh, evidently not. He was gloomy, hesitating. I supposed that he would not wish to play chess that afternoon. This would dispense me from leaving my rooms on the day much too fine to be wasted in walking exercise. And I was disappointed, when picking up his cap he intimated to me his hope of seeing me at the cottage about 4 o'clock as usual. It wouldn't be as usual. I put a particular stress on that remark. He admitted, after a short reflection, that it would not be. No. Not as usual. In fact, it was his wife who hoped, rather, for my presence. As he had formed a very favorable opinion of my practical sagacity. This was the first I ever heard of it. I had never suspected that Mrs. Fine had taken the trouble to distinguish in me the signs of sagacity or folly. The few words we had exchanged last night in the excitement, or the bother of the girl's disappearance, were the first moderately significant words which had ever passed between us. I had felt myself always to be in Mrs. Fine's view her husband's chess player, and nothing else a convenience, almost an implement. I am highly flattered, I said. Have always heard that there are no limits to feminine intuition, and now I am half inclined to believe it is so. But still I fail to see in what way my sagacity, practical or otherwise, can be of any service to Mrs. Fine. One man's sagacity is very much like any other man's sagacity. And with you at hand, Fine, manifestly not attending to what I was saying, directed straight at me his worried solemn eyes and struck in. Yes, yes. Very likely. But you will come, won't you? I had made up my mind that no Fine of either sex would make me walk 3 miles there and back to their cottage on this fine day. If the Fines had been an average sociable couple, one knows, only because leisure must be got through somehow, I would have made short work of that special invitation. But they were not that. Their undeniable humanity had to be acknowledged. At the same time, I wanted to have my own way. So I proposed that I should be allowed the pleasure of offering them a cup of tea at my rooms. A short reflective pause and Fine accepted eagerly in his own and his wife's name. A moment after I heard the click of the gate latch, and then in an ecstasy of barking from his demonstrative dog his serious head went past my window on the other side of the hedge, its troubled gaze fixed forward, and the mind inside obviously employed an earnest speculation of an intricate nature. One at least of his wife's girlfriends had become more than a mere shadow for him. I surmised, however, that it was not of the girlfriend, but of his wife, that Fine was thinking. He was an excellent husband. I prepared myself for the afternoon's hospitalities, calling in the farmer's wife and reviewing with her the resources of the house and the village. She was a helpful woman. But the resources of my sagacity I did not review. Except in the gross material sense of the afternoon tea I made, no preparations for Mrs. Fine. It was impossible for me to make any such preparations. I could not tell what sort of sustenance she would look for from my sagacity. And as to taking stock of the wares of my mind, no one, I imagine, is anxious to do that sort of thing, if it can be avoided. A vaguely grandiose state of mental self-confidence is much too agreeable to be disturbed recklessly by such a delicate investigation. Perhaps if I had had a helpful woman at my elbow, a dear, flattering, acute, devoted woman. There are in life moments when one positively regrets not being married. No, I don't exaggerate. I have said moments, not years or even days. Moments. The farmer's wife obviously could not be asked to assist. She could not have been expected to possess the necessary insight, and I doubt whether she would have known how to be flattering enough. She was being helpful in her own way, with an extraordinary black bonnet on her head, a good mile off by that time, trying to discover in the village shops a piece of eatable cake. the pluck of women, the optimism of the dear creatures. And she managed to find something which looked eatable. That's all I know, as I had no opportunity to observe the more intimate effects of that comestible. I myself never eat cake, and Mrs. Fine, when she arrived punctually, brought with her no appetite for cake. She had no appetite for anything. But as he had a thirst, the sign of deep, of tormenting emotion. Yes, it was emotion, not the brilliant sunshine, more brilliant than warm, as is the way of our discreet, self-repressed, distinguished, insular sun, which would not turn a real lady scarlet, not on any account. Mrs. Fine looked even cool. She wore a white skirt and coat, a white hat with a large brim reposed on her smoothly arranged hair. The coat was cut something like an army mess jacket, and the style suited her. I dare say there are many youthful subalterns, and not the worst looking too, who resemble Mrs. Fine in the type of face, in the sunburnt complexion, down to that something alert in bearing. But not many would have had that aspect, breathing a readiness to assume any responsibility under heaven. This is the sort of courage which ripens late in life, and of course Mrs. Fine was of mature years for all her unwrinkled face. She looked round the room, told me positively that I was very comfortable there, to which I assented, humbly, acknowledging my undeserved good fortune. Why undeserved, she wanted to know. I engaged these rooms by letter without asking any questions. It might have been an abominable hole, I explained to her. Always do things like that. I don't like to be bothered. This is no great proof of sagacity, is it? Sagacious people, I believe, like to exercise that faculty. I have heard that they can't even help showing it in the veriest trifles. It must be very delightful. But I know nothing of it. I think that I have no sagacity, no practical sagacity. Fine made an inarticulate bass murmur of protest. I asked after the children, whom I had not seen yet since my return from town. They had been very well. They were always well. Both Fine and Mrs. Fine spoke of the rude health of their children, as if it were a result of moral excellence, in a peculiar tone which seemed to imply some contempt for people whose children were liable to be unwell at times. One almost felt inclined to apologize for the inquiry. And this annoyed me, unreasonably, I admit, because the assumption of superior merit is not a very exceptional weakness. Anxious to make myself disagreeable by way of retaliation, I observed in accents of interested civility that the dear girls must have been wondering at the sudden disappearance of their mother's young friend. Had they been putting any awkward questions about Miss Smith? Wasn't it as Miss Smith that Miss DeBarrel had been introduced to me? Mrs. Fine, staring fixedly but also coloring deeper under her tan, told me that the children had never liked Flora very much. She hadn't the high spirits which endear grown-ups to healthy children, Mrs. Fine explained unflinchingly. Flora had been staying at the cottage several times before. Mrs. Fine assured me that she often found it very difficult to have her in the house. But what else could we do, she exclaimed. That little cry of distress, quite genuine in its inexpressiveness, altered my feeling towards Mrs. Fine. It would have been so easy to have done nothing, and to have thought no more about it. My liking for her began while she was trying to tell me of the night she spent by the girl's bedside, the night before her departure with her unprepossessing relative. That Mrs. Fine found means to comfort the child, I doubt very much. As he had not the genius for the task of undoing that which the hate of an infuriated woman had planned so well. You will tell me perhaps that children's impressions are not durable. That's true enough. But here, child is only a manner of speaking. The girl was within a few days of her 16th birthday. She was old enough to be matured by the shock. The very effort she had to make in conveying the impression to Mrs. Fine, in remembering the details, in finding adequate words or any words at all, was in itself a terribly enlightening, an aging process. As he had talked a long time, uninterrupted by Mrs. Fine, childlike enough in her wonder and pain, pausing now and then to interject the pitiful query. He was cruel of her. Wasn't it cruel, Mrs. Fine? For Charlie she found excuses. He at any rate had not said anything, while he had looked very gloomy and miserable. He couldn't have taken part against his aunt, could he? But after all he did, when she called upon him, take that cruel woman away. He had dragged her out by the arm. As he had seen that plainly. She remembered it. That was it. The woman was mad. H. Mrs. Fine, don't tell me she wasn't mad. If you had only seen her face. Dot, but Mrs. Fine was unflinching in her idea that as much truth as could be told was due in the way of kindness to the girl, whose fate she feared would be to live exposed to the hardest realities of unprivileged existences. She explained to her that there were in the world evil-minded, selfish people, unscrupulous people. These two persons had been after her father's money. The best thing she could do was to forget all about them. After Papa's money? I don't understand. Poor Florida Barrel had murmured, and lay still, as if trying to think it out in the silence and shadows of the room, where only a nightlight was burning. Then as he had a long shivering fit, while holding tight the hand of Mrs. Fine whose patient immobility by the bedside of that brutally murdered childhood did infinite honor to her humanity. That vigil must have been the more trying, because I could see very well that at no time did she think the victim particularly charming or sympathetic. It was a manifestation of pure compassion, of compassion in itself, so to speak, not many women would have been capable of displaying with that unflinching steadiness. The shivering fit over, the girl's next words in an outburst of sobs were, "Oh, Mrs. Fine, am I really such a horrid thing as he has made me out to be?" "No, no," protested Mrs. Fine. "He is your former governess who is horrid and odious. She is a vile woman. I cannot tell you that she was mad, but I think she must have been beside herself with rage and full of evil thoughts. You must try not to think of these abominations, my dear child." "They were not fit for anyone to think of much," Mrs. Fine commented to me in a curt positive tone. All that had been very trying. The girl was like a creature struggling under a net. "But how can I forget, she called my father a cheat and a swindler. Do tell me, Mrs. Fine, that it isn't true. It can't be true. How can it be true?" She sat up in bed with a sudden wild motion, as if to jump out and flee away from the sound of the words which had just passed her own lips. Mrs. Fine restrained her, soothed her, induced her at last to lay her head on her pillow again, assuring her all the time that nothing this woman had had the cruelty to say deserved to be taken to heart. The girl, exhausted, cried quietly for a time. It may be as he had noticed something evasive in Mrs. Fine's assurances. After a while, without stirring, she whispered brokenly, "That awful woman told me that all the world would call Papa these awful names. Is it possible? Is it possible?" Mrs. Fine kept silent. "Do say something to me, Mrs. Fine," the daughter of DeBarrel insisted in the same feeble whisper. Again Mrs. Fine assured me that it had been very trying. Terribly trying. "Yes, thanks, I will." She leaned back in the chair with folded arms, while I poured another cup of tea for her, and Fine went out to pacify the dog which, tied up under the porch, had become suddenly very indignant at somebody having the audacity to walk along the lane. Mrs. Fine stirred her tea for a long time, drank a little, put the cup down and said with that air of accepting all the consequences, "Silence would have been unfair. I don't think it would have been kind either. I told her that she must be prepared for the world passing a very severe judgment on her father." "Dot, wasn't it admirable?" cried Marlowe, interrupting his narrative. "Admirable." And as I looked dubiously at this unexpected enthusiasm, he started justifying it after his own manner. "I say admirable because it was so characteristic. It was perfect. Nothing short of genius could have found better. And this was nature, as they say of an artist's work. This was a perfect fine. compassion, judiciousness, something correctly measured. None of your disheveled sentiment. And right. You must confess that nothing could have been more right. I had a mind to shout, brava, brava, but I did not do that. I took a piece of cake and went out to bribe the fine dog into some sort of self-control. His sharp comical yapping was unbearable, like stabs through one's brain, and Fine's deeply modulated remonstrances abashed the vivacious animal no more than the deep, patient murmur of the sea abashes a nigger minstrel on a popular beach. Fine was beginning to swear at him in low, sepulchral tones when I appeared. The dog became at once wildly demonstrative, half strangling himself in his collar, his eyes and tongue hanging out in the excess of his incomprehensible affection for me. This was before he caught sight of the cake in my hand. A series of vertical springs high up in the air followed, and then, when he got the cake, he instantly lost his interest in everything else. Fine was slightly vexed with me. As kind a master as any dog could wish to have, he yet did not approve of cake being given to dogs. The fine dog was supposed to lead a Spartan existence on a diet of repulsive biscuits with an occasional dry, hygienic bone thrown in. Fine looked down gloomily at the appeased animal. I too looked at that fool dog. And, you know how one's memory gets suddenly stimulated, I was reminded visually, with an almost painful distinctness, of the ghostly white face of the girl I saw last accompanied by that dog, deserted by that dog. I almost heard her distressed voice, as if on the verge of resentful tears, calling to the dog, the unsympathetic dog. Perhaps as he had not the power of evoking sympathy, that personal gift of direct appeal to the feelings. I said to Fine, mistrusting the supine attitude of the dog, "Why don't you let him come inside?" Oh dear no. He couldn't think of it. I might indeed have saved my breath. I knew it was one of the Fine's rules of life, part of their solemnity and responsibility, one of those things that were part of their unassertive, but ever-present superiority, that their dog must not be allowed in. It was most improper to intrude the dog into the houses of the people they were calling on, if it were only a careless bachelor in farmhouse lodgings, and a personal friend of the dog. It was out of the question. But they would let him bark one's sanity away outside one's window. They were strangely consistent in their lack of imaginative sympathy. I didn't insist, but simply led the way back to the parlor, hoping that no wayfarer would happen along the lane for the next hour or so, to disturb the dog's composure. Mrs. Fine, seated immovable before the table charged with plates, cups, jugs, a cold teapot, crumbs, and the general litter of the entertainment, turned her head towards us. "You see, Mr. Marlowe," she said in an unexpectedly confidential tone, "they are so utterly unsuited for each other." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.